Well, good afternoon, sisters and brothers in the faith. Glad you all made it here today. We've got great weather. I didn't have to go looking for this subject today. Instead, it jumped up at me. Recently, I was reading in Genesis and came up to the part about Abraham, whom we call the father of the faith, or the faithful, and who is revered by three major religions. But I was puzzled to read some things in there, at least two bouts of weak faith that Abraham exhibited. And I must have read those before, but I had forgotten them. And in this message, we'll look at two times that when the father of the faithful used white lies, as we would call them, in an effort to protect himself. And in both cases, he used the same half-truth to try to avoid a perceived threat to his safety. Was God tolerant of these white lies? If you want a title, I call it Abraham's White Lie. We'll start today in Genesis 12, so please be turning there. White lies are also called half-truths, spin, alternate facts nowadays. And these are distortions that are prevalent and all around us every time we turn around. And we can get too accustomed to them as the normal way that things are. In verses 1 through 5 of Genesis 12, we're pretty familiar with those about God calling Abram, as his name was then, out of his native country and out of his extended ancestry, of his extended family from where he was born. And God promised to make Abram's descendants into a great nation. You all remember that, if he left his native land and his own father's extended family. So, after God's call in verse 4 of Genesis 12, Abram became a nomad at age 75, phenomenal, migrating from place to place with his own nuclear family, of his close family members, raising sheep. And by the time we get down to verses 8 and 9 of Genesis 12, Abram's group had arrived at a central part of what's present-day Israel now. And at Genesis 12:10, we read that a famine came, and so they had to journey further south to Egypt looking for food. And commentaries say that his wife, Sarai, was then in her mid-60s, of age. Abram was apprehensive what was going to happen, apprehensive about the Egyptians and how they would be treated, partly because of Sarai's great beauty, even in her mid-60s. And Abram knew the widespread custom of that time and region, that if you were the king, you could induct, so to speak, any single woman you wanted to become part of your harem. Now, if you were a gorgeous woman and they wanted you, but you were married, it's possible your husband somehow just might disappear. It might be eliminated so the single woman could be inducted into the harem. Now look at verses 11 to 15 in Genesis 12. 12:11, it came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, "See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' And they will kill me, but they'll keep you alive. Now, please say that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and that I may live on account of you." Now, to us in modern US of A now, this seems hard. It seems like transferring the risk, as it basically was, from Abram to his wife Sarai. So she goes into a harem so he can continue to live on without her. Now, this was a real head-scratcher to me. I couldn't figure this out. I tried for a while and then gave up. It's very hard to rationalize. Now, down in verse 14, it came about when Abram came into Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. That's into the compound to begin retraining and sort of going through finishing school. So far, Abram's worries have come true, but God had other plans, and he protected Sarai from harm, as we read in verse 17. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Then Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife?" Somehow, in this turmoil of royal plagues, the truth came out about Sarai before Pharaoh could enjoy a little hanky-panky with Sarai. So he continues to vent in verse 19, "Why did you say she's my sister, so that I took her for to become my wife? Now then, here's your wife. Take her and go. Get out of here." So Abram's household was deported by force from Egypt, embarrassingly. Now that should have left a lasting impression on Abram to avoid crafty white lies. But Abram still thought he was just being smart with the real truth, as we'll see a little later. So please be turning ahead now to chapter 20. Now Abram's entourage journeyed around for probably several more years in the general vicinity, accumulating more wealth, moving back up into the area of Israel, and receiving assurances of national destiny from God. And during this interval, Abram even had skirmishes with other local kings, a little war here and there. And after one successful battle, he famously gave to God through Melchizedek a tithe of the booty that he'd acquired and became the precedent setting that practice. And God had also renamed him by then Abraham, and Sarai was now Sarah, to pronounce it in English, and still quite a beauty. In Genesis 20, they came to a place called Gerar, and which was probably in, at that time, a Canaanite territory. Abram encountered there a king called Abimelech. It's probably not his given name, because that name is two words, Abi meaning father and Melech meaning king. So it means father king, probably a title like Caesar, because there's more than one of him mentioned. And again, the royal dilemma arose. The king wanted Sarai, or Sarah. So in Genesis 20, verse 2, Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, again, "She's my sister." So Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took her away. But God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, because she is married." Now, Abimelech had not come near her, it says in verse 4. And Abimelech said, "Lord, will you slay a nation, even though it's blameless?" Speaking of his household. "Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' And she herself said, "He is my brother." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this," that is, taken her into the household. "And I also kept you from sinning against me. I did not let you touch her." Then God let Abimelech off the hook, provided he restored Sarah back to Abraham. But God also, in this action, upheld Abraham in this dream. He upheld him as his prophet, whom the king should ask to pray for him first. Now, this seems almost ironic to me, but that's what it says. So after some alarm and panic in the palace, Abimelech, the innocent but clearly shaken, demanded an explanation from Abraham in verse 11. Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely there is no fear of God in this place. They will kill me because of my wife." And Abraham went on, justified his deceit this way: "Besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. But she became my wife." Even after decades of blessings from God, Abraham still used this half-truth to deceive out of fear for his own personal safety. It was an outright deception, and Abraham had to know it. Again, with God's involvement, this blew back in his face embarrassingly. So what lessons can we draw from these strange anecdotes? Well, one is that God didn't seem pleased with those white lies because he revealed them to the other parties. But how could and why would God put in the Bible such embarrassing accounts about the father of the faithful? What can these tell us today? I'll share just a single non-obvious thought, which has more to do with God than with Abraham or his actions. My main takeaway is this: God is patient, true to his word, and keeps his covenants. Repeat, God is patient, true to his word, and keeps his covenants. And Abraham's story is just one example of God's faithfulness. These things are written as our examples today. And Abraham responded to God's call. He accepted God's challenge and his promise. God had made a covenant with Abraham, and vice versa, Abraham with God. God knows our substance, that we're just flesh and dust. Sometimes we can't help things. We get panicked. We trip up occasionally. He doesn't expect us to have instant or complete perfection in the flesh. And when we do trip up, we try to correct our steps, but we can make no guarantees of the future. God, however, remains true to his side of the bargain. He has a purpose that he's working out in us, like in Abraham. And he will keep at it, and so should we. God is patient, true to his word, and keeps his covenants. Happy Sabbath.